Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Jules Dervais on Radio EcoShock. With his three adult children, the Dervais family raises inspiring amounts of food right in the city, and this could be the way we feed ourselves in the future, I think. What is the value of doing this for people? It's got to be bigger than just feeding yourself, as important as that is.
Right. Well, it began that personal need to take care of your own needs and getting your food directly, you know, instead of going through all the middlemen and who's your farmer and where is your farmer and how are they farming. This was an empowerment process of taking back this in our own hands, which we lost over the centuries. But it's gone more than that, because what we've done is change our lifestyle from city people disconnected from nature. And now, I mean, we are so in touch with nature. We're watching nature all the time. You know, when it's like your future is bound up with our connection with nature. So you have to take care of a lot of things that you never thought you let somebody else take care of. You let maybe the experts take care of. And now it's become myself and my children's lifestyle to just change the way we live and how we can survive for the future.
Yeah, well, your website says Path to Freedom. You have an award-winning short film on YouTube called Homegrown Revolution. It sounds deep and political, social change. How does that come from growing your own food? Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yes, well, you know, food being the essence of life, you can't get any more real than that. And we took back control of that. See, it had escaped us over the years by the generations. My parents let go of it, and then I was letting go of it when I was in college. You know, I had no idea that I would want to, you know, do this for a living, you know, this is my life. And it also has now freed us from all the other political powers and corporate powers that are out there. We look at it as weaning ourselves back to a strong, self-reliant family, the way the nation was founded and how people became strong in the past. They were strong units, individually strong, and they formed a strong nation. So this is the real, you know, politics of this is that the strength is in the individual growing their own, and in a family situation growing their own food. It's like you become now a core, a cell that is very strong, and that you can build a strong units around that too. You know, if you get a bunch of people doing the same thing.
Well, let's see if we can squeeze in just a couple more tips for people who want to do it. To get so much production from your city lot, you must be using vertical layering. Can you talk to us about some of the plants you grow and how they fit in with one another?
Okay. Yeah, well, certainly with such a small space, we have to take advantage of everything that we have. So we even grow produce down our driveway, down our fence line, in the front yard. We do a lot of use of arboring and trellising. So I mentioned before that we use fence lines are critical. Plants grow up. Some are vining plants. So we have a lot of grapes that give us shade at the same time that we had a good harvest of grapes. It's like it's a challenge to see if you can grow not just horizontally but vertically. Now, on a field, you get your choice of all the spaces that you want. But in the city, you have to look at it like, well, how about above here? So if you see a picture of my place, which we have a lot on the internet, and plus on Google, you can Google us, you know, and see how we live. But a lot of it's in the vertical space. So plus I told you about the containers. We tucked containers in around, even in shady places. We can get some produce out of the shade. So we're using the whole lot, sides lot. You have to be able to determine where the plant grows best. So the best thing you can do is to have a mobile space. So sometimes the container gardens are your advantage. They're not limited to the ground. So you can kind of move them around and see where they thrive, see where they do best. And it's always an experiment like that.
Well, you raised the problem of global weirding, and I think there's two aspects of that I'd really love to get your expertise on it. One is, how do you manage your garden during a heat wave so that it survives?
Wow, yeah, we had that. We're doing it right now, by the way. You know, we've had hundreds just recently, and then what I try to do is I try to shade the plants so they don't get stressed by the heat. So what we'll do is we'll grow some tall plants that'll give a little bit of, they like the heat. Like, say, tomatoes like the heat and corn likes the heat. and some pole beans like the heat. And then behind it, just in a little nook behind it, I can grow some plants that need shade. They might need light, but they can't stand this blazing heat that they have. So we have to adjust it for shade. We can grow things in shade in a hot climate. So this is like a work in progress. We're always looking for ways to grow more. And one of the things to get out of the heat is to find a shading spot. Also, we have some shade cloth that we hang over beds every once in a while when it gets really, really tough out here. It'll cook the plants with the blazing sun. So we'll put a shade cloth on top of the beds.
Right. And another problem that can come up for other folks in other parts of the country is they think they're doing fine, but suddenly there's this really strong, gusty wind is threatening to blow everything down and everything over. Any ideas for that one?
Fortunately, we don't have that too much, except in the spring and the fall. Most of the time, we don't have weather in the Southern California that's known as, kind of like no weather at all here, just hot, hot, or hotter. You know, that doesn't have much wind. So what we have, and we're in a city, so we don't get these, we have wind breaks. So it's not like living out in the country where the wind picks up over miles and miles and miles and can really cause you trouble. Yeah, I don't have the experience with the wind, but we do have block walls, fences around. And we do have our own windbreaks. I know in the open fields of the prairies and everything, they would plant trees as windbreaks to cut the force of the wind. You slow it down. You'll probably never eliminate it, but you'll slow it down. So, yeah, you can tuck things around around the buildings. The building acts as a windbreak. So if it's a windy side, then you grow something on the other side of the, take it out of the wind. Or build yourself some sort of break, like a fence of bamboo or something like that, a bamboo reed fence. You can slow the wind down. I don't know if you can completely eliminate it, but you can slow it down. And then we trellis our plants. We put in stakes so we keep them upright so they don't. They also have support so the wind can't blow them down.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Jules Gervais, a pioneer in developing a sustainable way of life in the city. Jules, what should listeners know if they hope to get a little extra income from surplus produce?
Okay, well, that would be great if you could do that. What I first would suggest is they grow what they needed for themselves. Like, if you grow what you like, first of all, and if you're fortunate enough to have some neighbors and some extended family, or maybe a church group, or at work that you belong to, you can start to get some of your produce into that arena by asking them if they would like to buy from you. So we didn't have that situation here, so we went to the restaurants here in Southern California because there was a lot of restaurants. But if you're able to have neighbors that would buy from you, or your family, share the produce with your family, then definitely get them on board, and they'll love you for it. And they'll ask you for it, so you can almost be guaranteed that they'll want more. Then if you do better there, you can maybe go out and try a local small family type restaurant, no big chains, but you can see if they would want some of your fresh produce. And if you're in a area like we are, the trendy area, they love this stuff. I mean, this they can't keep enough of it on the shelves. This is the trend today: local, fresh, organic. And you can fetch a premium price. So what we do is we don't grow volume, but we grow enough small stuff, but that is so valuable that we can raise the price on the produce, that we call them heirloom specialty crops.
And as you know too well, in California, as the economy sours, literally millions of people are starting to think homegrown food is better than money in the bank. Tell us about the resources you offer on your website and maybe how to use them.
Okay, well, we have quite an extensive list of website sources that you can use. First of all, our blog is called littlehomesteadinthecity.org, and that's like a daily journal of all the problems we face and how we're doing. But we also have social networks, free social networks called freedomgardens.org, which then connects you with basically sometimes you don't know it, but you might be talking to one of your neighbors in your backyard that share their information. So I might not be able to tell you about the weather up there, but certainly somebody on Freedom Gardens might be able to be helpful. We also have a part where we use barnyardsandbackyards.org, and that's for people that want to keep animals in the city. We have a store called urbanhomesteadsupply.com. That's something that we You can find out what we use on the farm here. We can get you in touch with the produce and the products that we use. And then, of course, our film, Homegrown Revolution, that you mentioned, that's always inspirational to get everybody up and wanting to plant. Oh, yeah, and then, okay, the main one is urbanhomestead.org.
Right. Okay, well, that's quite a list. What I'm going to do, I'm going to put it in my blog as well at ecoshock.info. So, listeners, if you didn't manage to write that down, but certainly if you start off at urbanhomestead.org, you're going to get somewhere. Jules Dervais, life keeps on changing. What is coming up for you and your family? Do you have some new projects in mind?
Well, right now we have this problem. We've had too much compost, so we're just maxed out our place. We've got a mound of compost that is needs getting to, and we're trying to find more people that are in this area locally that want to share. We have a front porch farm stand that if they have produce, we can offer it as exchange for something else. So we're kind of sharing our way of life on the front porch. And then the next thing would be for my grown children to actually do this themselves. So we're looking at a community of like-minded people that want to do the same lifestyle that we're living and maybe do it 365 days a year, 24/7 days a week. We're trying to change the way we live. And so the next step would be more like getting a community together.
And as we wrap up, is there any message you really want to leave with our listeners?
Oh, yeah. I would say start something now, because you never know where it's going to take you. Sometimes people might delay it. They might not have the perfect circumstance, and nobody does have it. So you have to start. That's first of all. And then stay with something. There's adversity along the way, and there's problems along the way, but you get to choose your problems. I mean, there's problems in the world, problems on the stock market. This way of life has problems, too, but you stay with it, and hopefully you become smarter and share with others. That's what we're looking for, is a common spirit of sharing, like they did in the old days, the old spirit of, you know, it's the neighborliness and people helping each other, not waiting for an agency or a corporation or government or anything. It's more like self-reliance, and definitely go out and be in touch with your own family and then with your neighbors. So we're looking for everyone to start sharing.
It's always a pleasure to hear from leaders and innovators in any field. And when it comes to food self-sufficiency in the city, that is the Dervais family. There's Jules, Justin, Anais, Jordan. And to find out more, you can go to urbanhomestead.org. Jules Dervais, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, Alex, I enjoyed it. I hope to talk to you again. And I wish you well in everybody's, and also everybody in their endeavors, too.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith at EcoShock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock.
The massive fires that are blazing across central and eastern Texas.
The weather has haywire over much of the nation tonight. New York and New Jersey were hit with a tremendous amount of rain, up to 3 inches in 1 hour.
Record storms, record droughts. Radio EcoShock listeners know the climate is out of control. We see the energy system and the financial system going into a long, bumpy road that could lead to collapse. But maybe you don't know, we're running out of a key fertilizer feeding the population bubble. And are you a member of a common security club? Or can money survive the end of growth? I'm Alex Smith, and we're about to explore all that with someone who knows. Richard Heinberg was among the first to explain peak oil to a world audience in books like The Party's Over and Power Down. Now the senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Heinberg pops up everywhere in documentaries and mass media. He's just done a whopping number of interviews about his new book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Trying to pick up what others miss, Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's very good to be with you, Alex. Thanks.
Richard, the last time we talked, it was about the almost inevitable blackout of fossil civilization when coal becomes too hard to find or too expensive to mine. I think you found another serious and surprising threat in your new book, namely the bottleneck of phosphates. What are phosphates and why should we care?
Well, phosphate is important to agriculture as nitrogen. And when farmers apply fertilizer to their field, usually they're applying a mixture of nitrogen, phosphate, and some other nutrients. But Phosphate is, unlike nitrogen, it can't be introduced by, let's say, planting legume crops or doing crop rotation. It's mined as rock, and the U.S. reached peak phosphate 20 years ago, so we're importing a great deal of the stuff. Most of the phosphate rock being used internationally these days comes from Morocco. And we're likely to see world peak phosphate within the next 10 or 20 years. And we really have no plan B in terms of global civilization.
Did you happen to look into the results of phosphate mining? Because it leaves a lot of uranium waste. That's another problem with it. I wouldn't expect everybody to know about that. I just happened to research it in the 90s, and there's tons of it in Florida. Just for your information, it's called phosphogypsum, and there's more radioactive waste from phosphate mining piling up in Canada and now in Africa. It's just one of those problems that nobody talks about, and it's part of this whole picture of fertilizers.
Right. As we move away from natural cycles, we end up with all of these environmental problems.
Let's get back to the bigger issue, and this is in your book, The End of Growth. What happens if we can't get enough phosphate or we just can't afford to buy it?
In that case, we end up with peak food, which, of course, is going to be even more serious than peak energy because we can do with considerably less energy, particularly we in the already industrialized countries. But having less food is going to be much more problematic given the fact that we have a growing population. It's true that there's a lot of food waste in the system, and we could make our distribution of food much fairer and more efficient. However, the reality is that we're already seeing food supplies stretched to the limit around the planet, and food prices are already a serious problem in poor countries. That's one of the factors that led to the uprisings in North Africa and in Middle East earlier this year. So the reality of peak food, I think, is getting less and less theoretical all the time and much more of a worrisome prospect.
True. It looks like we could hit peak agriculture soon if we haven't already. Well, in your book, The End of Growth, the subtitle is Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. So using that peak phosphate example, what can we do to recycle this key fertilizer?
Well, the word recycle is key here because we can't replace phosphate. What we have to do is recycle it through animal and human wastes and also use agricultural practices that make phosphates that are already in the soil more available to plants. That means promoting forms of agriculture that don't kill the soil, that actually promote microbial life within the soil because that microbial life actually makes the nutrients in the soil available to plants. As we rely more and more on adding chemical fertilizers to the land, what that essentially does is break down the microbial life, and our plants become sort of like junkies. You know, they rely on this human-supplied fix rather than being able to access the minerals and nutrients from the soil.
And I read in the journal Bioscience, there's an article there called Peak Phosphorus, and it said that some cities in Sweden are already requiring toilets to divert the urine to reclaim waste phosphorus. Man, America seems a long way away from that conversation.
Yes, well, we may go back to the days of the venerable outhouse in the future, only they may be more sort of high-tech outhouses that are capable of recycling waste.
Let's move on to something else that you've covered in your book. I'd like to cherry pick another good example of adapting to an economy that has already overdosed on growth. Richard, talk to us about common security clubs as a solution.
Right. This is an idea that sprang out of a think tank in the Eastern United States Institute for Policy Studies. They've since been renamed as resilience circles. So if you want to find out about common security clubs, you might Google either that term or resilience circles. Basically, it's just a way of encouraging folks to get together with their neighbors and talk about their common economic problems as our global economy goes into contraction. especially us Americans, we have this tendency to personalize our economic problems, to think that, you know, if we're out of work or if there are massive layoffs, something like that, it's all our fault, it's all our problem, and it's up to us to deal with it individually. The reality is that the economy is fundamentally flawed, and a lot of people are going to be hurt by this. And if we're going to respond, we're going to have to do it as communities, as neighborhoods. And so common security clubs or resilience circles are a way of getting people thinking about economic issues in a bigger way and talking about them with their neighbors.
Richard, we've seen extended families almost demolished in North American corporate culture because jobs cause people to move around so much. There were statistics that people were moving every 3 years to a different city, a lot of people. And if you don't want to join the local church, it can be hard to find mutual support these days. Can we rebond without those older institutions?
Well, I think we can. Another way that this is happening is through transition towns, which bring together things that are usually already happening in communities, local food systems, rideshare networks, car share networks, and so on, and get people talking to one another again and also sharing stuff. Tool libraries are a terrific idea for helping people, you know, gain access to, say, gardening tools and repair tools that they don't necessarily need to own themselves. It knits communities together and gets people sharing. And sharing is going to be a really key element in our adaptation to this new economic reality. Over the past few decades, we've been encouraged to buy more and more stuff. So every family has its own washer and dryer, its own lawnmower, its own you name it. This was beneficial to a growing consumer-based economy. But in a contracting economy, in a world of peak resources, we're just not going to be able to do that anymore. We're going to have to share a lot more.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book, The End of Growth. Richard, this book made me question some basic assumptions, and here is one. The whole banking system is based on the idea that money can multiply endlessly. We have compound interest, and capital is supposed to grow. My question for you, can money survive the end of growth?
I don't think our current money can survive the end of growth because we have a debt-based money system. Every U.S. or Canadian dollar in circulation right now represents that amount of debt somewhere in the system. How we got to that point is sort of a interesting story that I tell in the book. I won't go into that now, but we really have to get away from debt-based money because those debts imply the requirement to pay interest at some point. As long as the economy is growing, then more loans are being taken out, more money is being created, and therefore interest can be paid off and everything goes along just fine. But if the economy stops growing, as it's doing now, then suddenly a lot of interest payments can't be met and we see massive defaults. And again, that is what we're starting to see. That's why we're seeing the banking problems in Europe. And I think we'll see the banking problems reemerge here in North America. So we have to get away from debt-based currency, and there are plenty of models around for how that can be done with mutual credit clearing systems, local currencies, and so on.
And I've got to be honest with you, Richard, when anyone starts talking about economists, my mind kind of turns off. Millions of people have lost faith in these experts now that their plans and predictions are falling apart. Who is going to replace the academics and the politicians who are still right now praying hard in that church of endless growth and telling us that's the answer? Who's coming up to replace them?
Well, you know, there's been a school of ecological economics for, 20 or 30 years, and these folks have not gained much traction in the world of conventional economics, but they have made some very significant points that I don't think can be refuted. They point out that conventional economics has some fundamental flaws embedded at its very core. The idea, for example, that the environment is a subset of the economy. It's just a set of resources that we extract and turn into useful products to sell. The reality, of course, is that the entire human economy is just a subset of the environment. if we have no environment, we have no economy. Herman Daly has been talking about these issues for many years, and there are a number of other important ecological economists around the world who are bringing issues to the fore about peak resources, the need to transfer to a non-debt-based currency, and so on. So they're being proven right with every passing day that conventional economics has it wrong. And the principles of ecological economics are all laid out pretty clearly in textbooks and popular books. So it just needs to become the mainstream.
Richard, through your books, The Post-Carbon Institute, your many speeches, you must be one of the most plugged-in people on the planet. I'm wondering, how do you survive that intense throughput, all the information all the time? How do you handle it personally?
Oh, well, I spend a lot of time in our backyard garden with our fruit trees and garden beds and chickens, and I also spend a lot of time making music. I play the violin, mostly chamber music, classical music, and play with friends. And I think that's the kind of pastime that is going to get us through to the next era, depending less and less on electronic mass entertainment, which just sort of jangles our nerves and leaves us as consumers of images and sounds, and gets us back to being, you know, producers of music and art, and participants in the intellectual life of our community.
I really like that answer. Surely part of the learning process for any author is the feedback, the further growth after you publish. What have you learned from the reaction to your new book, The End of Growth?
You know, I think I've learned that the book is still, even with all that we've seen over the past 4 years with the economy, it's still a bit on the leading edge. We put a lot of effort into getting mainstream media attention on this book, and it's been very difficult because the mainstream discussion is still very much about how we get back to growth and the idea that we're not going to get there, that growth in conventional GDP growth is just no longer available. It's still just too big a stretch for most media outlets. So it's a bit of a tough slog. And I have to say I'm surprised because the signs are everywhere that this is what's happening, that we have we've reached the limits to growth.
As we wrap up, if you met a longtime friend on the road, and I think many of our listeners count on you as a longtime friend, what is your parting advice? Is it time to leave the old economy behind? Should we leave, or should we pull harder where we are?
Well, of course, it depends on each person and where they are, but I have to say I think it's really important right now that we develop local resilience and detach ourselves from the global economy as much as we can, as fast as we can, because it's a ship that's going down. And this is controversial advice, because if everybody becomes more self-sufficient and consumes less and saves more, the result is that causes the economy to contract even further and faster. But the reality is that's what everyone needs to be doing right now, because that mainstream global economy is going nowhere.
You have been listening to Richard Heinberg. Find him at richardheinberg.com. And by all means, subscribe to his free monthly called The Muse Letter. I do. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
I'm Alex Smith. Find this interview and tons of free radio downloads at ecoshock.org. And as always, thank you for listening and thank you for caring about your world. Thanks to my friend Vast Mandana on SoundClick for this little bit of end music.